Hello everybody and welcome back to another spoiler review with me, a Border Prince. Today we are talking about Apocalypse by the amazing Josh Reynolds. So what happens in this book? Well, basically it's covering the world of Almace, which has been cut off to a greater or lesser extent by the birth of the Great Rift. Now, I've done a lore video on the Anchorite, and we'll get to that shortly, and that kind of covers a lot of what's going on with the Almace thing. But to put it succinctly, it's a fairly self-contained system, which its capital world is a cardinal world, so ruled by the Ecclesiarchy. It is relatively prosperous with mining and multiple worlds, agri-worlds. It's quite self-contained. It can support itself. It doesn't require imports of food and whatnot. It's got its own defense fleets. It's got its own garrison forces. It's got Sisters of Battle. It's a fairly affluent area. So they've been able to hold off the enemy up to this point, but they're about to fall. And Aemon, the Cardinal Governor, sends word to Terra to ask for aid. Now, at first he's rebuffed, but he then sends a special coded message that he has had passed down to him down his family's line, which is directed towards the Primarch, which was given to his ancestor by the Primarch, because he is the jailer of a being known as the Anchorite. I'll cover that though in a moment. So, what happens then is a task force is deployed from the Indomitus Crusade, by order of the Primarch, to help defend the world. And this consists of a mixed force of Raven Guard, White Scars, and Imperial Fists, under the command of a Lieutenant Calder, who has overall command. But the White Scars guy actually outranks him. Now, it's interesting what Josh Reynolds does here, and I won't delve into the ins and outs of this, because it's kind of just character interactions, but it's nice what Josh Reynolds has managed to achieve here in terms of showing the interaction and the annoyance that the old Marines have with the new Primaris Marines. The conflict, the distrust, the difference between them. The fact that the Primaris are aware of this. And there's one moment where they discuss how, you know, one day they will accept us fully. It's an interesting way of covering it, and more I like what the authors are doing to deal with this massive lore problem, which GW itself, the lore team, the codex writing team and whatnot, are not dealing with sufficiently at all, in my opinion. They've just forgotten about it. And if it wasn't for the novels, we would have nothing. These guys arrive on the planet. In the system, I should say, because the word bearers have invaded, and it's under the command of someone called Amatnim. Now, he is a Chaos Warlord, and he is one of the standout characters of this novel. I really, really like this character. He is a fanatic, like most word bearers, but he's done a nice juxtaposition here with having him and then having the chaplain, what are they called? The Dark Apostle of the Word Bearers, Lakimu, I think he's Lakimu, and who's frothing at the mouth. But what Josh does here as well is explains a lot of stuff about the internal workings of the Word Bearers. So we learn that the Word Bearers are, we learn a lot about their religious elements, which we've heard about before, but this delves into them more. For instance, there's continuous updates to how the religious edicts from the Dark Council of Sicarus, saying that, you know, you need to paint your colour, this colour, red. And it's continuously changing. And we learn that it's like it's a way of keeping the word bearers sharp on their religious belief, that they have to keep maintaining this. You know, it's a way of keeping their culture alive, I guess, and keeping the authority of the council at the head, because people have to obey this. We learn that there's a conflict still between Erebus and Corpheron for dominance of the council. And Lekemu and Amatnim are both like representatives of one faction or the other. Amatnim is with Corpheron, and Lakimu is an agent or a representative, I should say, of Erebus. Now, it's interesting what happens there with this conflict and their competition with each other and what they're trying to achieve. Now, for Imatinib, he has received a vision from Lorgar, and we learn also that Lorgar has disappeared for several hundred years, and people are waiting for him to come. And for that, that's one of the reasons why the Legion is kind of suffering. It's starting to fray and break apart. They can see that they are no longer the predominant power within the Eye of Terror. They even complain about the strength of the Black Legion and the fact that even Mortarion is now leading the Death Guard, and discuss like when he's going to return. Interesting. Fascinating internal politics of the Legion. And one of the most interesting legions as well, which we don't hear enough about, I don't think. Now, what follows in the novel is a series of... it's basically tracking the invasion of this Word Bearer's Armada. How they join up with a pirate force, and we meet an interesting character, Prince Genor, who is an exiled noble whose family were usurped by the Ecclesiarchy, which again is a nice touch showing how the Ecclesiarchy will use its power and influence to take over the sort of temporal world. Very much, if you're into history, you'll be aware of like the wars of religion and how the conflicts between the sort of the priesthood, the Catholic priesthood and stuff. It's nice. It's a nice touch and really adds depth, and it's world building. And this is what I love about 40K. You get this world building of creating this vast interstellar empire with all of these different factions and groups and how they conflict with each other. And it's the ambitions of men and so on. It's good stuff. I like it. What carries on from there, though, is a number of awesome battle scenes. The White Scars basically leave a contingent on the planet, and the rest of them go out under the command of their captain, who leads them in a sort of hit-and-run thing. The smaller Astartes fleet and the remnants of the System Defence Force against the Wordbearer's fleet, trying to slow them down, giving the other Astartes on the planet under the command of Kaldor, who's, of course, an Imperial Fist, so lots of little wink-wink, nod-nod jokes towards building walls and so on are in the book, which is, again, it's a nice touch. And I love Josh Reynolds because he shows that people have a sense of humour, and I like that. You know, it's a grim sense of humour, but it's like, well, why wouldn't they? Of course they'd have a sense of humour. They are transhumans, but they're not machines. They're not human anymore, but they're not machines, you know. The fundamental part of them is human, and they would go insane if they didn't have jokes, they didn't have friends, they didn't have senses of humour. It's a good touch, and it really humanises them to a degree, but not like ridiculously. If you get me, it's not over emotional. These are warriors, soldiers, you know, they have that gruff sense of humour. But they're, you know, at times philosophical about things and so on, but they have a purpose which they carry out to the end. The Raven Guard are really interested in this as well. There's some moments where they, so on the planet, they're trying to recruit the local criminal elements of this cardinal city, of this cardinal world, and get them on side. So you have this great moment where this Raven Guard dude is tracking down the local mob boss. We meet this guy, and he's impressed because this guy isn't scared. He's just letting rip with his machine gun at the Astartes, which is beautiful. But they eventually get them on side. And yeah, it basically leads to that. And then there's a bunch of like amazing moments on with the Word Bearers trying to get these pirates on side to use them as chaff, basically to make up for their numbers. Because the first world they invade, called Pergo, they take a number of losses. And it was more of a test for Imatinib, whether his fleet, this armada he's gathered, can actually take the main world. And this is a test run. And he takes more casualties than he wants, but he thinks he can do it, especially when he gets these pirates on side. But during that conflict, so he's been on a sort of personal quest that he believes, or has been given to him by the Primarch, to track down a lost hero of the Legion. And that is the Anchorite. And he's been tracking him for centuries, millennia, I suppose. He's one of the original legionaries, it seems. Lacamu is not. He was recruited after the heresy, it seems, or just during it. So he was never like an emperor worshipper and everything. So for him, it's always been a chaos a chaos alignment for the Legion. That's all he's ever known. We get interesting... The character dynamic between them is great because Imatnim is far more of a... He's far more knowledgeable and really powerful, but he isn't like a... He is a religious fanatic, obviously, but he's not like a dark apostle. He is a commander. He is a leader of men. He is the epitome, the ideal of an Astartes war leader. Whereas Lachemish is a frothing-at-the-mouth fanatic who is loyal to Erebus, who... you know, summons demons, all that sort of stuff. Whereas Imatnim is kind of more aligned with the old style of the Legion, I guess. And, you know, the warrior side of that rather than the chaos-believing religious fanatic side. And in general, he's just a badass, to be honest. He's just cool. They go to this world on Pergo, that's the one. And they invade, and they're fighting through the streets and so on, and they confront a bunch of Sisters of Battle who are defending this sort of final library sanctuary. And there's some great moments in there. He has, like, a wounded sister, and he's, like, offering to end her pain if she just accepts the gods and stuff like this. It's nice. It's really well put together. It's really good. Once they take this place, however, they are confronted with the fact that a lot of the work there is in old Colchisian. So... Imatnim knows that he's on the right track. He knows that he's almost there. He's almost found what he's looking for, this lost hero. And Lacamu is disgusted. You know, they're taking the words of their law, of the Aurelian and corrupting them. Because obviously this is all stuff from the Lactitio Divinitatis, the holy book that Lorgar wrote before the heresy, before he turned to chaos, saying that the emperor was a god. And this book would later go on to become the sort of foundation stone of imperial belief in the god emperor. Brilliant. Fantastic. I love it. Right, so they invade then the main system. Now, Lacamu is sent to take out the asteroid mining facilities, which are around the planet. And again, Josh Reynolds manages to show humanity in this conflict, to show sense of humour in this conflict. The Raven Guard are there, rallying the miners to resist the invasion of the Word Bearers. And we get amazing moments, for instance... Some of the cultists, a dude cultist and a female cultist, they're, you know, talking about how the word bearers are, they stink of rotting meat and stuff like this. Talking about the demons that are coming because they're taking that many casualties. Lacamu decides to summon a bunch of demons to sort of turn the tide in this little guerrilla war that they're fighting. And they sneak off to, they have a drink together, they have a chat. And then they sneak off to try and bang, have a little bit of peace and quiet and have a quick shag up the corner to make themselves feel better. Which it's like, yeah, that's what people do. That's what people do. And I like the sort of realistic sexualization, I guess you'd say. I'm not really into that sort of thing in these 40K novels. And I find that Josh Reynolds is probably the best guy to present that kind of humanity. Because it's like it's a fundamental part of most people's lives, you know, their sex and relationships, you know, dudes like women, women like dudes. This is a fundamental thing, and you often lack that in a lot of the stories for good reason. And I'm pretty happy with it being like not really covered that much, but you know, Dan Abnett's done a reasonable job with it as well. Like it's there. But it's not like overblown or, you know, just made such a big deal of. It's just like, okay, well, these two are in a shitty situation. They want to sneak off and have 5 minutes of just a bit of solace, little quick bang up the corner. Why not? And it's nice. It's a nice touch. And I do think it added humanity to the situation. And it also adds humanity to the Chaos Cultists. And you get to the Renegades, you know, you get an idea of... They are just human. They just have a completely different outlook and perception of reality. They have embraced the power of the Dark Gods, which I like, you know. And I think he's done a good job with that in like the Fabius Bile novels of showing that, you know, like you can say like the Imperials are the good guys, but they're not really. And in this reality, in this universe where the gods are real, their position of worshipping these gods is just as appropriate, is just as reasonable as people aligning with the Imperium. Now, we might look and go, oh, you know, the brave Imperial Guard, the Imperium, that's great. That's who I would be aligned with. But not necessarily. Not necessarily. If your only experience of the Imperium is of, you know, being chastised, being hammered down on, and then you have this other side, which is offering you freedom and the opportunity to excel, it doesn't take much to change people's perspective on the situation. That's what I'm saying. I can understand how it's a reasonable position to take. And I'm just ranting now, so I'm going to move on. But you understand what I'm saying, surely, yeah? From there, we move to the invasion of Almaes itself. And this is great. So Calder has set up a massive defence of the city. He's fortified the place as best as he can, just as he's like his natural inclination, because he's an Imperial Fist, is defence. And he's done that. And he's organised the resources at his disposal in order to defend this position as best he can. And the word bearers attack. They throw in their chaff first. And this is where we get one of the deepest, the most resonant little sections, which I think could be slotted into any conflict, I guess. But obviously in the 40k universe, it's particularly resonant. So this Prince Genor, who we understand is touched by the gods. He has some kind of demon trying to lure him. He's been chosen by Slaanesh, but he's not been turned completely. But there's something's going to happen there. And this is what the Chaos Space Marines say. And it's one of the reasons why they spared him. Because a lot of the pirates wanted to turn on the Astartes and leave. But they couldn't because they were too close to the Astartes fleet. The Chaos fleet. And in the end, the Chaos Space Marines turn up and slaughter most of the captains of the fleet in order to ensure their loyalty. So the pirates were on site. But Genor is sort of the leader of the pirates, roughly. But he lands on the planet. And this was supposed to be his triumphant return to this planet he was exiled from. It's his inheritance to take this world back in his family's name. It's his right. And he lands there. And he lands there amongst fire and death and ashes. And in the landing field, they're landing like a little park. And the trees are on fire. Or it's starting to spread, this fire is. But under the one tree, a fruit tree, is this traitor guardsman. And he's standing there and he offers Genor a fruit. And they have a conversation, which is amazing. And it fundamentally ends in, the Chaos guy saying to him, it's a fire. It's a fire and it's going to spread and burn the universe clean. But I'm just a spark in that fire. And you are a spark in that fire too now. And Genor is like disgusted by this. He thinks he sees something moving behind the Chaos guy's eyes. And the Chaos guy just goes and joins the cultists. This is after he's explained that, you know, they send the meat in first to sanctify the ground before the word bearers will come, you know, with a few of us like professionals to bolster them up and get the fanatics moving and everything. And it's quality. It's quality. He goes off then. And Genor turns though and sees the fire spread to the tree he was under. And burning up the fruit tree. And it's a great moment. And it's one of the standout moments of this book for me. I really, really liked it. Next we get to the Imperials fighting against the horrible Chaos Hordes. But we get an amazing moment. And there's a Sisters of Battle canoness in this, who's leading the Sisters forces. And the Imperials in general. This chick's getting wet at the opportunity to slaughter heretics. She is super excited, this old gal in her power armor, and she's screaming prayers and extolling the Imperial soldiers to sing. And then there's an amazing moment where Calder and his Primaris, they ask Calder, shall we join in singing? And they do. So you got to imagine these a bunch of Primaris with these massive, massive throats start singing Imperial songs too. And the entire Imperial gun line stops and stares at them. And the sister's like, oh, this is amazing. Yes, look, the angels sing with us. Sing! And the Primaris falter for a minute and then they carry on singing and they all sing together songs to the Emperor as they're gunning down hordes of cultists. And it's a nice scene as well. It's quality. As well, there's a bunch of politicking that's going on in there and stuff. And they think that Aemon's, while their preparations are going on, they think that Aemon's hiding something from them. So the Raven Guard, being Raven Guard, sneaky, sneaky, they follow Aemon and they discover his secret. So in the vaults underneath is a prison, I guess you'd say, a tomb that contains the Anchorite. Now, the Anchorite is a word bearer who was in the legions. He fought through all of the heresy. He fought for the Great Crusade. He fought through the heresy. He went through the change of belief to the Chaos Gods. But on Kalth, he turned from the Chaos Gods and the worship of Chaos and re-embraced his belief in the Emperor. And he surrendered to the Ultramarines. And the Ultramarines, and Gilliman in particular, personally, spared him and kept him in prison. And then Gilliman gets knifed in the neck and put in stasis, and the years go by. But the Anchorite doesn't attempt to break out or anything. He stays loyal and carries on doing his worship. And what appears to have happened is his jailers appear to have become sort of founding members, almost fathers of the Church of the Emperor somehow. And his writings, based on the text that based on the beliefs that he was given by Lorgar in his original training, belief in the Emperor as a god and so on, become integral to the foundations, to the foundation documents, the texts that found the Church of the Emperor. And that's what happens, basically. And 10,000 years later, he's attempted to commit suicide a bunch of times because he just can't take the sin of his past and he wants to die. But he's still alive. He's in a Contemptor dreadnought now. And Aemon's family are the hereditary jailers of this guy. You know, and there's a nice element where he explains his family's past as well. And he says, you know, occasionally there's been no direct descendants. So in that case, my family has gone into the streets and found a young lad who is capable, healthy, and made them the next in line, trained them up to be that. And that's happened a few times over the 10,000 years. But you've got like a solid hereditary line for 10,000 years of these, of people who were level, and they must have been at the foundation of the Church of the Emperor because they're hereditary cardinals. But what goes along with that hereditary cardinalship, because that's not normal, is that's not completely normal, I should say. It happens. But to go along with that is making sure that being the guardian, the jailer of the Anchorites. So having discovered this, Calder confronts him and he's basically, he meets the Anchorites and they explain the situation to him. And Calder's just like, what the fuck? Why has Gilliman sent me here? Did Gilliman intend for this to happen? Because this is major. He understands the implications of this. And the implications is religious schism, religious civil war, when people find out what the origins of the church are, that they're all based upon this text of Lorgar, which the rest of humanity has mostly forgotten. I mean, the heresy is a myth. You get me? You have to understand, it's 10,000 years. You think about us. What do we know about 10,000 years ago? Not much. Not much. The most, like, solid piece of historical stuff that we have is like 2,500 years ago, with Sumerian texts and stuff like this, and some Chinese mythology, things like that. You know what I mean? Like, and that's here, that's on Earth, that's the bedrock of our civilization. So 10,000 years after all of what's happened in the 10,000 years, and the fact that humanity was a mess anyway, even during the Great Crusade, really, it didn't really have time to cement the ideals of the Great Crusade and spread that knowledge that they did manage to claim back after the Age of Strife. You imagine, they don't know nothing. They don't know nothing. All they know is the Emperor's a god because reasons. Because the reasons that they get given by their priests. That's it. That's as far as history is. And Calder even says this, you know. He says at one point, I don't read fiction. When he's asked about whether he's read the history of the church. And he's like, nah. You know, like, nah, this is all nonsense. It's all just allegory and children's stories. Because he was there, of course, because he was recruited following the heresy. So he was alive during the heresy. Stuff like that, man. It's quality, you know, as a child, obviously. So he's got, like, vague memories and recollections. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. Really good stuff. But eventually, it ends in a confrontation. And this is because Calder, even though he was advised that they're not soldiers, they're fanatics. And the word bearers don't view victory in the same way that he will. He still kind of thinks of them like that. So he plans around an invading force that's logical and not insane. So what the word bearers do is they launch a ramming attack with their Thunderhawk gunships. their gunships, their dropships, where they just throw themselves into the Imperial defences and smash through them and ram their ships into the middle of the Imperial defences to reach the Anchorites, to reach the centre of the Cardinal City, where they know that, where Amatnim knows that this, whatever is going on here, because he doesn't really understand it either. He just knows that there's a lost word bearer from the Heresy, trapped prisoner, and that's what he wants to save. Because he thinks as well that it's gonna bring power to his side of things, that it shows that he's right about how he perceives the reality and the future of the Legion. There's a lot of like internal politicking, and it's nice. So what they do is charge through, even though they lose, like, they only have like a third of their force left by the time they land, and it's like no logical person would do that. So Calder's a bit shocked. But it sort of allows the word bearers to breach the defences easier, even though with massive casualties, they do something that they shouldn't have been able to do. So, in the end, the Anchorite marches forth to war. This is after he's asked Aemon to kill him. Aemon says he can't do that. He goes, okay, well, I'm going to confront them. And that's what he does. And it's a great moment where he's basically just dressing them down. You get Amatnim completely distraught when he hears the words that are coming out this ancient contemptor dreadnought's mouth. He's disturbed, he's disgusted, he's shocked. And eventually that ends in Calder killing him. But they try and take out the contemptor dreadnought. They're trying to take him captive, get him out of there, get him off the planet, take him back to Sicarius, even still. But he's like, no, you know, you are fools. Why would I want to go back there with that snake Erebus and, you know, Corpheron? Why? These people are evil. They're traitors from the start. Our Legion was founded on lies. It's good stuff. It's quality stuff. And it's beautiful. It all sort of links together. And that's where the story basically ends. Now, what we have is, what's going to happen afterwards? Is this information going to spread? It surely must. Now, we know in the time frame that this is happening towards the start of the Indomitus Crusade, roughly. Or at least, the Indomitus Crusade is going on. So, this is before... We know that Mortarion is leading the Death Guard. But I don't think it's at the... So, how it works in the timeline, Gilliman ends the Indomitus Crusade and then returns to Ultramar to fight the Plague Wars because Mortarion has invaded the 500 Worlds. Great. Okay, so we've got a rough timeline about it. It's happening after the start of that. So the Great Rift has happened. It's been a few, I think, months. Or I think it says years, I'm not sure. But not that long. So it's quite at the start of the Indomitus Crusade. So I'm interested that nothing else has occurred in the 100 years since then up to the start of the Plague Wars with Gilliman. So, I mean, obviously there's different writers, and again, Black Library at this point are a bit notorious, and GW lore is a bit notorious of being proper, like, disconnected. Although there is some good connections that are happening now in the books compared to previously. So, he obviously hasn't spread out yet, that information, because we would have seen the effects of it already. But it is going to spread out soon, because too many witnesses, it's too apparent what has occurred, and I want to see what these effects are going to be. I want this to be carried on. I want this character to have an effect on the universe. Because I think it's a great character that Josh Reynolds has created. I love the religious, philosophical stuff with 40K. And I want to see more of that. But it's got to be done properly. You know, you can't just have some fedora-tipping atheist writing stuff that he doesn't really understand. You know? And that's what I want to see more of it. I want to see what's going on here. Because this is got the potential to be really interesting. And we're getting that as well now with what was happening with Guy Haley stuff with Gilliman. Reading the Lorgar book, the Divinitatis. Reading that book, encountering an avatar of the Emperor, a saint of the Emperor, when the Emperor possessed a little girl and burned her up because his power was too great, which is pretty shocking. You know, not necessarily a good guy. You get me? Not necessarily a good guy. Also, we get mention as well. Lakimir mentions that Korax is in the Eye of Terror hunting the Word Bearers, and I just want to slip this in before I forget, which I think is a nice tie-in to the Heresy story, which covers that, which I still haven't read. I've got to get through that Primarch's short story collection. I only read up to the Sanguinius one, so I need to get through that. I need to carry on reading it. And I'll do a review of that soon, because that sounds fascinating. And some good little tales in that I have read so far. So that's happening. Another thing we get is, you know, the internal politicking of the Word Bearers, how this is going to affect them. Because obviously it's a great revelation to these guys, because a lot of them don't really appreciate that their Primarch once worshipped the Emperor as a god. They don't appreciate their history, I guess. And they're riven at the minute. And Lorgar is away, but he is going to return soon. Very soon. Oh, and also how they describe Korax's shadow, which I thought was nice. It's the shadow cast. He is the shadow cast by the Astronomicon. So this light of the Emperor that shines out in the universe is the reason. That's the power that Korax is drawing upon to make himself invisible. I like that. Aside from that, we get some lovely interactions between old school Astartes and Primaris, ripping on each other. We get Astartes bad-mouthing the Primaris and how they fear for the future with them. I think it's a beautiful story that's being told here. Now, apparently, I was told by a friend of the channel, Skywatcher Adept, that Josh Reynolds had done an interview recently with some dude who does like reviews and in like a blog, and Josh Reynolds was saying that basically he wanted to do a number of stories, but all of his ideas, all of his pitches were shot down, so he just came up with this. And that's amazing that this wasn't like something concerted that he had planned out. He just, everything he wanted to do, they wouldn't let him do. So he had to come up with something else, and they let him do this. And I'm like, well, what was he planning on doing that they let him do this, but the other stuff they wouldn't? Amazing. It doesn't seem like, well, I know now that Josh Reynolds is writing the third Fabius and Bob book, because he's put that out on his Twitter. But other than that, it doesn't look like he's doing anything else at the second. And so we're going to have a bit of a gap now for Josh Reynolds stuff until next year, probably, when the next Fabius book comes out, probably about March, based on previous like release schedules. If he's still writing it now, it won't be out this year. Probably, maybe we're looking at towards the end, like, so, I don't know, July, June, maybe, if we're lucky. So that's a while off. So we're going to have a bit of an empty space now. And I'm a bit worried that they're going to try and push some authors who aren't quite as good. And some stories that no one really wants to hear, you know, which are bad. Because I've seen a few books that I'm not like keen on. I don't know what's going on. The really good stuff is Josh Reynolds, Chris Reid, and Guy Haley. They're the best three at the moment. You know, everybody goes on about Dan Abnett. He's a good writer. He's great. But he doesn't do much for the GW anymore. And he hasn't done much in terms of like this new era, this new Dark Imperium, this new Indomitus era. These guys are the ones who are saving the lore right now. And if one of them is not getting an opportunity to do stuff, that's concerning. I don't know why not. But on the other hand, Guy Haley is a machine and he's churning it out. I am just listening to the great work, Belisarius Call, which I recommend you all get, and there'll be a review out for that shortly. I know there's been a bit of a gap in my reviews over the last couple of weeks. I've just been doing other stuff, but I'm going to be back on cranking through the books and putting the reviews out and the lore out related to them. And I've got to read the Chris Wright stuff. I'm behind on the Vaults of Terror. But yeah, I want Josh Reynolds' stuff. It's great. I want another one of those Lucas the Trickster novels. He's a fantastic character. Why aren't we seeing more of him? That was a real hit, it seemed. Yeah. Anyway, that's pretty much all I've got to say, really. This book opens up a lot of possibilities for the lore. There's a lot of interesting stuff. The character interactions are great. There's some good laughs in it. Again, not over the top, but subtle. There's some really humanizing elements for people that you would not normally humanize. So enemies of the Imperium. You get some real idea of, I don't know, like normal human interactions. Even though they are fanatics and zealots and things, you get some nice touches. Like, for instance, there's a moment where one of the Word Bearers is getting shaved by his slave. It's just, one of his slaves is Varva, and he's just getting shaved by him. It's great. It's a nice moment, and it really adds, again, it's world building and adds realism, adds character to the stories. Okay, so that's my review. It's worth getting. I would give this like an 8 out of 10. Purely based on the characters that are presented to us. But also on the potential stuff that this unleashes in the lore. And I hope that it's handled correctly and actually brought forward and not just forgotten about. I want this stuff to be integral to the lore going forward. Because it's quality. And once again, Josh Reynolds, he's never written a book I don't like. I'm sure if I even wanted to read that AOS book he did, I would like it. Even though it's AOS. Even though it's AOS, I would like it. Okay, well, that's a wrap. I do recommend you get it. If you want to try out Audible, you can use my Audible link below or follow the links over to Amazon where you can pick up a hard copy of it. This is the cheapest place you're going to find this stuff. Also, I would like to thank everybody who is supporting the channel. You can see your names here. Thank you all so much. It means a lot that you do support the channel. If you ever feel the need not to support the channel anymore, though, don't worry. I won't be a dick to you if I ever see you in the chat. It's perfectly fine. You're understandable. But I'm grateful for any support I get. It's fantastic. Anyway, I will see you next time. Thanks very much for watching. And please remember to like and subscribe and all that stuff. I'll be back again soon with more. Maybe a more coherent one and less rambling. But we'll see. Probably not. All right, see you later. Bye-bye.